All right, so we are in Romans 5. Is Romans 5 important? Yes. Romans 5 is important because what we see here is Paul is bringing a lot of threads together into a single spot. He has introduced some major themes that we talked about: faith, peace, hope, love, the glory of God, all brought into this section. I have no idea what just happened. We used to have agape. Ah, now we're back. Weird. You can leave now if you want to. Doesn't bother me. You're an adult. So, what does he mean when he uses this term? That's the question. Well, an easy definition of that is the willful act to seek the good of the other for the benefit of the other. You choose to do this. You choose to do something good for someone else solely for their benefit. Now, can we do something good for someone else for our benefit? Well, yes. We can go help a homeless person and get extra credit for a class. Is that agape?
No.
It's a willful choice. And so what he says is this willful choice is something that God does. And it has been poured out into our hearts. How is it poured out? Well, it's through the Spirit. So, people use examples of funnels all the time. May I borrow your bottle for a moment?
Sure.
Pretty well empty. Mm-hmm. So we have a bottle here. I could pour out the contents, and where would they go? They'd go on the floor, right? But how would I redirect them into a certain, and what would happen when they hit the floor? They'd cause a splash and might soak through to the president's office, then I'd be in real trouble, right? How do I direct the contents of this bottle into a certain place? Well, lo and behold, they have this little opening. Whoa, I got to be careful about that. There we go. Let's put that thing down for a second. Okay, this little funnel opening. Now we have some cups. You drink out of a cup, and you don't spill. And we have pop cans. You drink out of it's not a pop can because that's no longer pop or Coke or whatever you want to call it. I have no idea what it is. Probably illegal in 47 countries around the world. But what happens when you drink out of a container like that? Or what happens if we're drinking out of a bowl, right? You have a bowl and you put it up to drink out of. What happens? It makes a big mess. Some of you may not have tried that. But it goes everywhere. Well, how does the love, which starts with God, get where it's intended? That's the preposition. Does Greek have prepositions? Yes. I don't want anyone to write on the essay on the midterm about objective, subjective, genitive that Greek does not have any prepositions, because I've heard that before. And it's wrong! Right? So it's poured into ours through the Holy Spirit. So now we have both Jesus and God and the Holy Spirit in the same places. There is no Trinitarian doctrine in the Bible. Once upon a time there was, because some people got confused and they inserted it into a text. And so if you go to 1 John and read sometime and you pay attention to the verse numbers, all of a sudden verse 8 of chapter 5 will disappear, because around about 800 or 900 it started showing up in texts, but way back in 300 it wasn't in any of the texts. It's called the Trinitarian formula. But the Trinitarian formula says God is three in one comes from trying to understand what Paul's trying to get across. Because there are two options. There is monotheism, and radical monotheism at that, which Paul presents. And there is polytheism, many gods. Right? And if Paul is talking about God and Jesus and the Spirit, is he talking about three gods? If he is, he's no longer monotheistic. He's polytheistic. And yet Paul continually affirms his Jewishness. And the argument of Romans is God is one. So Romans 5 starts to become very interesting as you see this, these threads start to come in to play and to combine and to join at this point in time. Ah. But he also says we have peace through Jesus. We have love through the Spirit. We have peace through Jesus. Now, some people think the class is really hard. Okay, Kylie, if I wanted to make it hard, I could. Because I could say, make you pay attention to, like, love comes through what? Holy Spirit. Blank comes through Jesus. Peace. And you have to memorize all these little relationships. Not, I don't care about that. I want you to know what peace is and what he means when he talks about love. But the love through this, yeah. Objective, subjective, genitive, okay, we can deal with that. So, the other word is grace. So we have faith and hope and love and grace, but what's grace? It's the thing you say before you eat. A person who walks around campus. What does he mean by grace? We have obtained access to this grace. How? Through Jesus. So Jesus is the access to the grace. The word comes from charis, of which we get charismatic. We have charismatic individuals. We are blessed in this nation to once again have in the office a charismatic individual. People like him when they're around him. Right? Everybody loves the president. At one point in time, we had another charismatic individual. Bill Clinton. Engaging. The reports about him, you got into his presence, you just kind of fell in love with Bill Clinton, which came to be a disadvantage in some of his other activities. But a charismatic individual. Okay? Grace is a positive thing. You have to be old enough to remember that. I told you, Romans relates to everything. That's why we study it. Okay? But what he says is we stand in grace. So he's now painted this big picture, and I wish I was an artist, but I'm not. Okay? We have this situation where there is a problem. The problem has a name. Paul calls the name, the problem, sin. Sin's power. Humanity is under sin's power. That's the problem. That's the antithesis. Something took place. See, it's a smiley face. It's good. Justification. Jesus died and was buried and was resurrected. He died for the trespasses and he was raised for our justification. Because of that, all sorts of things take place. Love, peace, grace. It's like springtime. when the flowers start blooming and they just start popping up everywhere. And so Paul is saying, grace is that in which we stand. So what is grace? Now I know you've been reading through Romans chapters 4 and 5. You can stop at 5. That's the assignment. 4 through 5. It's enough. You don't have to go on and do more. 4 and 5. And I'm sure grace is a word that's just popping up everywhere. Well, not really. And you read it in chapters 1, 2, and 3, and grace popped up everywhere. Not really. And yet, we talk about how important grace is to this Christian message, and yet it's not something Paul, it's not a word Paul uses. What does he mean when he uses it? Well, we're familiar with it because way back in the beginning he says, verse 7, grace and peace to you from God and our Lord Jesus Christ. Greetings, grace, grace to you. What is this grace? It's that in which we stand. So if this justification has taken place and humanity is no longer over here, but they're over here, what is grace? It's about as hard to define as peace. But something to do with this relationship between humanity. Never done this before. This is cool. And God. Remember that little diagram? We talked about legalism and covenantal nomism. Paul is trying to describe for us this concept of a relationship between God and humanity. And he says it is filled with love and peace and grace. And those are words that define it. But can you define those words? Of course, God's redemption at Christ's expense. Make it an acronym. Is that what Paul says? No. He says, we now stand in this grace. This kind of relationship that is wonderful. Do you know any charismatic individuals? People you just love to be around? Right? People who are like, you come up and talk to them and they're your best friend and they know your name and they're very outgoing. You just it's wonderful to be in their presence. They're the life of the party in a good sort of way. Not in a bad sort of way, because I know some of you have those experiences as well. A good sort of way. And you just like to be around them. Do they have grace? Sometimes. How about an older lady you know who kind of took you in, was the grandma in the neighborhood that you didn't have and just kind of took you in and you just enjoyed being around her, and especially when she baked cookies, especially the peanut butter ones with the Reese's, mini Reese's cups in the middle and, you know, little stars and did things. You say that person is a gracious person. What does it mean to be gracious? Do people want to be around gracious people? See the adjectives we get in the English language, the concepts we get in the English language. Why? Because here in Romans we have this concept, grace is that in which we now stand. And I'll just remind you that the word standing is important. I'm going to give you some illustrations. It's never on the test, but it's important. So here we have all these terms, faith and hope and love and grace and peace, all brought together here. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel, the good news, the proclamation. Well, what does he talk about? Well, here in chapter 5, he is unpacking his thesis and he says, I'm talking about God's love being poured out. I'm talking about peace with God. I'm talking about the grace that we now have and can stand in it. Did I miss one of the terms? I'm sure I did, but that's okay. What does he talk about? How bad people are? No, that's the antithesis. What Paul wants to talk about is What is God doing? God is the subject. And he is pouring out. What's it mean to pour out? Bottle again. Thank you. Can you see there's a little bit in there? So if I just, I can pour it out, and what happens? Would you say it was poured out? No, it's already been poured out. To pour out. It's raining, hopefully it will rain. And we'll say it's what outside? It's pouring down. Does that mean it's a light mist? What's it mean? Maybe not a fire hose, but pretty much. It is just pouring out, pouring forth in abundance, more than we can really handle. Water's backing up on the streets. There's puddles. It's raining cats and dogs because you just stepped in a poodle. Because I didn't know when I was growing up that there were Portuguese water dogs. You know, now it's raining cats and dogs because you just stepped in a Portuguese water dog. But, you know, that's a new joke. Got to pay attention to things that are happening, Mr. Kathy. Right? So, 1 through 5 brings all these things together. Now Paul's going to keep on talking about what has God done, expressing himself. So, it says, while we were weak, has he talked about weak before? Uh-huh. Weak means to be without faith. Why? Because Abraham did not weaken in his faith. Weak doesn't mean you lose the arm wrestling challenge. Weak doesn't mean you're unable to walk up the stairs. Weak doesn't have anything to do with physical strength in Romans. It has something to do with faith. Because he says, while we were still weak, it says unable to work. We use that term, don't we? I'm too weak to go to work. Too weak to go to class. I don't know if you are or not, but sometimes that excuse comes forth. It says, to one who works, wages are not reckoned as a gift, but as something due. They're strong enough to do things, and they get what they are. But while we're weak, unable to work, without faith, what happens? God, nope, not here. Christ died. For who? The ungodly. Well, who are the ungodly? Well, that might remind us of something about these who worship idolatry, those who fail to acknowledge God. So now he's referring to in his thesis the opposites of things that he referred to in his antithesis. Did Christ die for the godly people? No. How do we know that? Well, we read 1 through 3. And what's it say? There is no one who is righteous. If no one is righteous, then they are unrighteous. If God is righteous, then unrighteous is not God. So it's ungod. So those who are not righteous are the ungod. I know I'm putting too much into it, but it's Friday, right? It's Friday. We got to learn something on Friday. Fridays are good. So in verse 5, he says, God justifies the ungodly. One who without works trusts him who justifies the ungodly. Do godly people need justified? See, the terms he's using just kind of mix and go, that doesn't make any sense. Because ungodly is unrighteous, justifies righteous. Do the righteous need to be made righteous? Well, no. The righteous do not need to be made righteous. But at the right time, Christ died for these people, for people who needed it. And he said in verse 4, Christ died for our trespasses. Who is committing trespasses? The godly or the ungodly? Right? So he's, I know, you're saying move on. Well, that's what he said, yeah. So all I'm doing in this class right now is exactly what Paul does in his letter, and you're saying move on to the next point. Linear thinking. Move to the next point. The next point. Paul just comes back and back and back and hits on the theme and hits on it and hits on it and hits on it and uses different words and different phrases to say what? Basically the same thing that he's been saying here. God is doing something for humanity that is under sin's power because they have death. So I will move on. Next point. He does what the weak and ungodly cannot do. If someone's weak, what do you have to do for them? You have to help them. You have to carry them. Is it possible for a weak person to be declared righteous? No. They can't. They don't have the strength to do that. And that's the whole point that Paul makes in 1 through 3. Humans cannot do that. Now he has some questions to respond to that, but that's later. So now we come to 5:8. It says again, God proves his love. In that while we were still sinners. So now he says, use another language, sinners instead of ungodly. Different language, same idea. Christ died for us. Okay? God shows his love. Well, how's God's love shown? What do we know about God's love? We just had it. It's been poured out to us, right? So, here's the real question. God shows his love by having Christ die. What's agape? You have a definition on there. The willful choice to what? To seek the good of the other for the benefit of the other. Is that right? Is God's love, God's willful choice to seek the good of the other now being humanity, solely for the good of humanity, so that they might no longer be under sin's power, but now stand in grace? Yes, but what did it cost? It cost a death, right? So when Paul's talking about God's love, what's God get out of it? That's a great theoretical question. Goes back to Paul's view of God. God created the world. Why? And people speculate. Oh, he was lonely. Mostly people who are lonely speculate that God was lonely. The extroverts who have to be around people speculate that. Well, they talk about God's creation being an act of love. Did he create the world for the benefit of others? Solely for the benefit? What does God get out of it? See, that's the question. Does he get something out of it? Well, yeah, you could say he gets something out of it. But did he do it in order to get that out of it? Because if God did something in order to get something out of it, is that love? And yet God is defined as love. Did God send Christ to die in order to get something out of it? If he did, it's not love. It's an interesting kind of portrait he paints here. Because it doesn't make any sense, does it? Because as humans, we do things. Why? So I can get something from you later. So we can have that network. So maybe later you'll do something. So I mentioned about these peanut butter cookies with chocolate Reese's in the middle. What do I want? Max, you know. A batch of chocolate peanut butter cookies with Reese's in the middle. Haven't had them in about 20 years. Nobody makes them like my neighbor did. So, you know. He says, while we were yet sinners, to be sin is to weak. We're weak. We can't do things. Right? Christ died. But that still doesn't answer the question. Because the word is, God proves his love. And see, I'd love to talk about why we need to deal with the exegetical part versus the hermeneutical part, because I'm sure that some of you have been said, prove your love to me. How do you prove your love to someone? And if you read another translation, well, it's not prove your love, it's demonstrate. Well, demonstrate your love for me. How do you do that? Well, you have to do something, right? Show me that you love me. These are languages we use all the time, and here God is saying, God shows his love. He proves his love. And so hermeneutically we think, well, God must have to do this in order to actually show us he loves. Does God have to do that to show he loves? Why? Because God is love. So what is that word? It's a very interesting word to prove. It's a Greek word. It was written in Greek. That has a preposition on the front. And the word stand. The best way to put it into English, I think, for today, is to stand behind. So I stand behind my word. I stand behind the agreement that we made. I stand behind this. It's technically to stand beside, which is kind of cool too. Here's love here, and here's this person standing beside them. Not going anywhere, standing beside them. And so this verse, which is very powerful, that says God demonstrates his love, he proves his love, is technically and literally God stands behind his love. It's as though humanity cried out and said, God, show us that you love us. And he stood behind his love with his entire being. Some of you heard of Ted Turner? Turner baseball, TBS, movies, all sorts of stuff. Back about 1999, he pledged $1 billion to the UN over a course of time. You know what happened in 2001 to stock market and values? They dropped. Guess what he did to his pledge? He took it back. Then after a while, he said, well, no, I've got money now, I'll give it. Did he stand behind his pledge? No. See, to stand behind something means your entire being is to make certain it happens. And that's why Romans 5:8 is so very powerful. Because God stands behind it. Where do we stand? Come on, we already had it earlier today. We stand in grace. We don't stand behind grace. We stand in grace. Grace is that which lets us stand up. Grace is that which allows us to be strong. Some of you had me in a class last fall, and I'd come into class, and I'd sit right here, and I would move the entire time. Because I bent over to pick up a Mountain Dew bottle to help load a concession stand, and I have a right paracentral disc protrusion, whatever the heck that means. Right? But it was pressing on my nerves, and it was almost impossible for me to stand for more than 5 minutes. Why? Because I don't have any physical strength. Because it made me weak. And this whole theme is built around weakness and strength and concepts of grace and peace and love, and they're all interwoven. Like that beautiful sweater you got for Christmas that you love so much. Right? All these colors interwoven to make something out of it. And then Paul repeats himself. Why does Paul repeat himself? Why do I repeat myself? There's two options. I either forget what I said, which for me is very possible, or two, what? It's important. In the ancient world, when you have to give a public speech, even in the present world, when you have to give a public speech, what do? You repeat yourself frequently so that they know what you're trying to get across. You go back and talk about things you mentioned before. I'm listening to a book called Blink. Anybody read the book called Blink? Okay. He gives an illustration in chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, he makes reference to the illustration he gave in chapter 1. And in chapter 3, he makes reference to the illustration in chapter 2 and in chapter 1. And in chapter 4, guess what he makes reference to? Again and again and again and again. He's always bringing up these illustrations to keep the point central of what he's trying to communicate. I highly recommend that you listen to it. It's actually in the library on CDs. You can check it out. Or read it, which it might be even better, called Blink. All right? So Paul repeats himself. While we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. God demonstrates his love for us, and while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. They're the same thing. We were weak, we were sinners. Christ died. Who's responsible for it? God is. Why? Because Paul's gospel and proclamation is about God, not about humans. If you read through it, pay attention to the subject. It's about what God is doing, not what humans are doing. Now he returns to the wrath of God. Have we heard about that before? So, much more surely, or certainly then, now that we have been justified by his blood, rut-row, Paul, I got you. You just said we're justified by his resurrection. Right up here, chapter 4. Raised for our justification. You said we're justified by faith. And now you said we're justified by his blood. What is it? Come on, Paul. Which one is it? That's the problem with Paul. He didn't sit down and say, I'm going to write a theoretical, theological treatise that will be understood by people in the 21st century. Nobody until that point in time is going to have a clue what I'm saying. He's writing a letter to a bunch of people in Rome that he wants to come visit about a very important message. God does what? Makes righteous. Is there a distinction for Paul between the death of Christ and the resurrection of Christ? I already told you this. No. It is one event. What we do in the modern world is we split the hairs. And we think Paul split the hairs. But Paul didn't split the hairs. He viewed it as one event. The death of Christ is part of justification just as much as the resurrection is part of justification. And if we want to split hairs today, that's fine. People will talk about that. But Paul didn't split hairs. He goes on to give another example of the same kind of thing. He says, much more certainly, having been made righteous through his blood, we will be saved. Will be saved. Future tense. Much more certainly. And then he says, if while we were enemies, we're enemies over here, what do enemies not have? Peace. Right? He's introducing this concept of conflict. Has he had conflict before? Yes, we were under sin's power. We were unrighteous. We were unable to do what God wanted. If we were enemies, we are reconciled to God, being brought back into that relationship through the death. The death of his son was for trespasses. Is the death different from the resurrection for Paul's thinking? Not really. He's building up this, it's a very lovely passage. If that happened, much more certainly we will be saved. It's 20 till for those who have to go. The concept of salvation is very important. The emperor was the savior of the world. As Paul talked about salvation previously, a little bit. That's the issue. How does this take place? Well, every Roman would tell you, because the emperor has saved us, he's delivered us. But Paul says we will be saved. What from? That thing over here. Death. Does Paul have any doubts that that'll take place? Listen to his language. If God can do this, this will happen. If God can do this, this will happen. If God can create the world, can God raise the dead? Give child to the childless? Paul's view influences his arguments. If God is able to do X, then Y is certainly possible. So much more surely then, having been justified with blood, will we be saved from the wrath of God. Well, what's the wrath of God? Is it still those lightning bolts that God's going to throw down and punish somebody? Is it still God's going to stumble up in heaven and bump his big toe and send a hurricane to punish a city? What's the wrath of God? The wrath of God is being handed over to just simply have whatever happens to us. So what is being saved from the wrath of God? God's no longer just handing us over. What's he doing? He's coming to our rescue. Right? He's catching us when we fall. We're no longer beyond. It's like the illustration of the child. We finally say, okay, you want to jump off the roof? Go ahead. And we let them jump off the roof, and they break their leg, and we get it healed, and it's in pink or blue cast, and everybody signs it, and after a while, they're up there again. What do we say this time? Go ahead? No. It says, I will prevent you from doing the stupid thing again. I'll catch you. I'll try and prevent that from happening. Or we do something like put a fence around the top of the roof so they can't climb up there. Somehow we prevent them from actually being able to hurt themselves. So we're rescued from the wrath of God. We are rescued and reconciled with God. So, has Paul gone back to the beginning and talked about something that he's talked about before? Yes. What's the gospel? God's wrathful and mad and angry at everybody? No, the gospel is God is wanting to save humanity from that. Despite the fact that they fail to acknowledge him, despite the fact that they're under sin's power, despite the fact of this and that and the other, God is working to not just hand them over. So, now we boast. Is it okay to boast?
Yeah.
That's the problem, isn't it? See, in the ancient world, it was great to boast about yourself. Paul said we can't boast. Why? Because we can't boast about ourselves. What can we boast about? We can boast about what others have done. So last night, my son goes to Kingman. Sorry. Playing in a basketball game. Pulls down a rebound. Gets the fifth foul on one of their top scorers. Yes! I can boast about that. Can boast about a friend who's traveled the world, helped people. Can boast about what others have done. Do we boast about what we've done? No, because we really haven't done anything. So if we're going to boast about something, we boast about God through Jesus Christ, through whom we've now received, and he uses the term reconciliation. Great new term we'll probably get to talk about on Monday. Right? What is this reconciliation? It's a deep term. I'm losing most of you. It's 11:45. We'll see where we go from here. It went blank. That's good. Reconciliation, great place to pick up on Monday, along with chapters 4 and 5. That's the instructions, chapters 4 and 5. Next time is 6 through 8. A, B, and C, plus what? An outline. Does it have to be 47 pages of an outline? No.